Your Honour, and just before Ms Baker Galloway continues, I've had a message from Ms Dixon to say that unfortunately her plane has made it to Christchurch, but it is currently too windy to land in Dunedin. Apparently they're going to refuel and they're going to try again, but I just wanted to alert you now that there is that potential difficulty.
That's okay. I think we have time, even if she's on tomorrow.
Yeah.
Indeed. Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you. So you're going to come back.
Yes, so I've looked at Mr Anderson's suggested addition to the second objective, and I can certainly see structurally that the main body of that would work. Mm. No objection to reference to stranded assets, as long as there's somewhere in the rest of plan change that's defined as it's been proposed by Mr. DePelsmaker as tightly as possible. Obviously, we have a different position in terms of renewable energy.
That's okay. Yeah. No, it was more the hook in the second sentence that that seemed to have some merit. And as I said, that's not an assessment. We've only read it once, but at the time it was... Yeah, it struck us as something as worthy as looking at,
avoided except in limited situations.
Yeah.
It would be even better if those were identified, and then it would be really tight, what those limited situations are, if they can be listed somewhere.
And that, I think, is what Mr. DePelsmaker's evidence is doing. It's got a schedule,
so
we know what they are. Yeah.
Which is the best way to do it, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of paragraphs A and B, not sure about those.
Neither were we.
Yeah. Especially A. A doesn't really help us at all, I don't think. And B.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't. I think that comes out of the original version B, and it didn't strike us.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. Righty.
Good, thank you. Okay, good. All right, so next section is on deemed permit dams, paragraph 14. Sort of in the same position as Mr. Page in terms of the relevance of the definitions of water body and water. Mm. So I'll just whip through paragraph 14. It's understood that there's no real dispute that the body of water behind a deemed permit dam is a water body in accordance with the RMA definition, as they are not excluded from the parent definition of water, not being in the subset of exclusions of being water in any pipe, tank or cistern. And I think it's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
They are water bodies. As such, those dams are captured by the NPCFM as well, and when it comes to fully implementing the NPCFM and what restoration of Te Mana o Te Wai means in the, I have got the right acronym there, FMUs, within which those dams sit, the assessment will be complicated by the fact that prior to those dams being in place, the well-being of the water body might have had quite a different character to that supported with the dam, which obviously now supports a different character water body with a different state of health in and of itself and supporting a different ecosystem. And the challenge in assessing how to give effect to the NPSFM in the context of these modified catchments is present in many catchments, and those with storage dams and diversions may be most complex. Modified catchments now support different ecosystems, and this is yet another reason why catchments and FMUs as a whole should be able to be assessed as unencumbered as possible by long-term consents when the land and water plan is progressed. This will require holistic and integrated assessments with as few exceptions as possible. And finally, in my submission, there was no compelling case why the maintenance issues associated with deemed permit dams should override the above. Those dams' deemed permits were due to expire this year. Those same maintenance issues would have been apparent in the years preceding now. And the challenges in terms of investment and certainty have obviously been overcome in the lead up to the expiry. On the issue of providing for hydroelectric energy at the expense of implementing the SPFM at the earliest opportunity, Fish and Game's position has not changed. By providing for the effective rollover of consents such as those for Trustpower's four races that divert basically all of the flow and four streams in the upper reaches of the Waipori scheme, renewable energy is being provided for, albeit for a shorter term than the rest of the consented Waipori scheme. Given the four races in question only contribute an order of 5% to the scheme, there's no evidence that the scheme is somehow rendered unviable or that there will be practical or operational concerns if for some reason the land water plan requires less water to be diverted. The NPSREG does not explicitly require that renewable energy be provided for at the expense of environmental or other bottom lines or other uses of national importance. I do acknowledge that the Climate Change Commission's recommendations include an emphasis on increasing the role of renewable energy generation to 50% by 2035. That's across the whole energy system, which includes electricity, process and building heat and transport. And this target is broadly equivalent to the 60% renewable energy as a share of total primary energy supply as outlined in the Commission's 2021 draft advice. However, these recommendations do not exempt application of environmental bottom lines or priority of allocation of resource between users and have to be weighted in that regard. By 31 December this year, there should be an emissions reduction plan and a national adaptation plan written under the Climate Change Response Act from the Climate Change Commission. And from that date, RMA decision makers must have regard to them. But until there is more detailed national direction beyond the NPSREG as to how renewable generation is to be weighted and at what expense in terms of environmental bottom lines, it is submitted that there is no justification for treating HEP take and use any differently in PC7. A rollover for 6 years will enable a review in 6 years' time of the national direction and whether the use of water for hydroelectric power should be able to continue on the same terms in the context of the direction in the NPSFM and any climate change related direction that must also be had regard to.
So what if you had to identify the issue as a question for the court to decide in relation to this particular submission, what would it be?
What's the issue?
Yeah, what's the issue?
Well, one issue mm-hmm. is that possibly by the end of this year, we will have those emissions reduction plans and national adaptation plans in place. And by the end of this year, the RMA, so it's the Resource Management Amendment Act 2020, says that by 31 December 2021, when you have to have regard to these reduction plans and adaptation plans and on your decisions on policy statements and regional plans. So one issue is that very soon there will be national direction that is required to be had regard to. And by rolling over the consents for 6 years, that means in 6 years at the latest, that national direction can be reviewed when the permits come up for replacement again.
So targets absent policy is not a matter in and of itself that should be given weight. In other words, the fact that the government has its own targets or even the Commission has recommended targets is not a matter in and of itself that should be given weight. It's the policy to achieve those directions and what which is the matter to have regard to. And so prior to hearing from government as to what that policy is, a six-year rollover is sufficient.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because if those consents are granted for longer terms, that delays implementation of the full suite of national direction.
Thank you.
I guess to round that off, one thing I probably should have put in writing. So when the land and water plan is notified, not only will it have to give effect to the National Policy Statement on Freshwater Management, under the RMA Amendment Act 2020, it will have to have regard to these emission reduction plans and national adaptation plans. So there's specific amendments to Section 61 and Section 66 coming, or in law, but they don't take effect till December.
All right, thank you.
So now moving on to scope for the two challenged parts of Fish and Games relief. So this section addresses the scope of relief sought by Fish and Game in accordance with the amendments to PC7 recommended by Mr Farrell in his supplementary evidence and the position reached by the planning experts in the 7th and 9th joint witness statements. There are two aspects of the amendments proposed in Mr Farrell's 24 March supplementary evidence which ORC contends are not within scope. A, to insert a new policy, 10A2, and a non-complying rule, 10A322, to apply to applications for new water permits. And B, to insert a new policy, 10A24, and table 10A24 with a presumptive minimum flow and allocation threshold to replace a no more than minor test. ORC contends that the amendments sought regarding new water permits are not about or on PC7, and that the amendments sought regarding the replacement of the no more than minor test are not within the scope of Fish and Game submission. So firstly, addressing new water permits, the relief sought is about or on the plan change. Fish and Game agrees with ORC summary on the principles of scope in the applicable case law regarding what on the plan change means, but does not agree that relief sought is out of scope of the plan change as notified. PC7's objective 10A11, as notified, explicitly referred to it, establishing an interim framework to manage new water permits, as well as replacement permits. I've just set out the quote for ease of reference. Mm-hmm. Policy 10A22, as notified, also directed that new consents for take and use of water was restricted to a duration of 6 years. So new permits are clearly within the scope of PC7, as is their duration, and PC7 left the activity status of those new permits untouched. Fish and Game considers that while it may have been ORC's intention for new water permits to be managed in this way, the extent of PC7 is not limited so as to make Fish and Game's amendments beyond scope. And Fish and Game's proposed change is entirely consistent with and better gives effect to what PC7 is all about. PC7 is about facilitating the transition from the operative water plan to a new regional land and water plan which achieves the purpose of the NPSFM through the development of an interim framework to manage fresh water until such a time as new discharge and allocation limits are set in line with the NPSFM. As per the latest joint witness statement, the experts have agreed on a new objective 10A11 which clarifies this intention. And one of the ways in which PC7 seeks to achieve this is through providing direction on the consent duration for all water permits to take and use water. PC7 provides direction through objective 10A11, both as notified and now as per the 9th joint witness statement, and policy 10A22 as notified and as it's evolved. But there is an inconsistency between that direction and the extent of coverage of the methods employed to implement it. There's a gap. Sitting under the objective, policy 10A22 now directs ORC to only grant consents for new takes for a duration of no more than 6 years. Yet the rules in Chapter 10A which implement this policy directive are incomplete, with the taking and use of surface water as a new primary allocation take remaining a restricted discretionary activity in accordance with Rule 12.146, regardless of duration. So there's a gap in PC7 in failing to include a non-complying rule in Chapter 10A for new primary allocation water permits that fail to implement the direction of Policy 10A22 to only grant consents for 6 years. Only grant is a strong direction, and a restricted discretionary rule will be less effective at implementing that direction than a non-complying status for consents with a term in excess of 6 years. Fish and Game submits that only grant is comparable terminology to avoid and is most effectively implemented through a non-complying activity rule.
Just pause there a sec. Rule 12.146 includes, as a matter of discretion, the matters which the council's limited its discretion duration.
Yes.
Yeah, it does.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Further, the introduction of the rule can be considered a consequential change flowing downwards from the objective and policy in the relief sought in Fish and Game submission that the six-year term apply to all water permits. Similar to the scenario discussed in Campbell, the new rule is consequential relief in that it introduces a method which gives effect to the objective and policy to ensure compatibility throughout the plan. Fish and Game does not agree with ORC's view that there is a procedural fairness issue here, and that potentially interested parties would have been uninformed of the amendments now proposed by Fish and Game. It's clear from the Section 32 report that the scope of PC7 extends to providing direction on the duration of consent for all water permits. It's submitted that a layperson's interpretation of the direction would not necessarily be limited to objectives and policies, as ORC suggests, and it could easily be an interested party's interpretation that direction includes rules, activity status and consentability generally. There were a number of submissions which sought relief along these lines, and a potentially interested person uncertain as to the scope of PC7 for new water permits, given what the objective and policy stated about new permits and consent duration, could have reviewed the summary of decisions requested and would have seen that a number of submitters sought to ensure the six-year term for new water permits, which logically would bring into frame the issue of activity status. At this point, they could have made a further submission or joined the proceedings as an interested party.
Now, do you have a list of those other submitters?
Yeah, so the next section details not just Fish and Game's submission, but a couple of the others that do have that same relief.
And when you say a number, how many are we talking about?
Well, we've highlighted the COES, the Central Otago Environmental Society one, Fish and Game's one, and... Those are the two we've highlighted, I think.
So one other, COES.
Fish and Games and COES.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the Fish and Games submission, this is at paragraph 37, sought general relief that PC7 develop an interim framework to manage all surface water consents, and that PC7 ensure only limited consents for short terms are able to be granted. The submission also sought consequential changes to give effect to the general relief sought, which Fish and Game submits includes introducing rules which implement policy direction. In its specific relief, in that table, Fish and Game supported policy 10A22 to limit all new consents to a duration of 6 years, and the submission expressly records that Fish and Game interprets the policy as limiting every consent, including new consents, to a term of no more than 6 years. The submission seeks that amendments are made to Chapters 6 and 12 to be consistent with the policy, and amend the provisions to make all applications for new surface water, including connected groundwater abstraction activities, non-complying. The submission by the Central Otago Environmental Society also provides scope. The submission states that there is a need for an interim regime that ensures any consent issued prior to the land and water plan is time limited to assure objectives of the NPSFM are not subverted. And then finally, on the merits, much was made of the limitations of the restricted discretionary rule itself, in particular that it does not enable a full assessment of effects to be considered, including on values important to Ngārunanga. Many agreed as to these limitations and that they posed a risk. And for this reason alone, it is submitted that it is not appropriate to allow applications for new water for terms beyond 6 years to be considered pursuant to the restricted discretionary rule and the two limited matters of discretion.
Just pause in. So is your concern that if you have a policy that, say, only allow or void, whichever way it's written up, consents for new activities for a duration of 6 years. But if you flip back into an RDA, it loses the force of only a now or a void, you know, which is not grant.
Yes.
Generally speaking, not allow, not grant.
Yep.
Yeah. And so it tends to muddle or confuse the messaging for the consent authority.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Because for consents longer than 6 years, where they are a new activity, they still fall to be assessed as a RDA.
Yes.
Yeah. Despite the not allow direction.
Yes.
Yeah. And so then what direction is given to longer than 6 year consents? It's whatever the matters of discretion are. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and so it's those matters of discretion which have been criticised in this hearing as being deficient.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Mm-hmm.
Good. Now moving on to more than minor table, the presumptive table, and the focus here is whether the relief sought is within the scope of submissions. ORC argues that the relief sought by Fish and Game to give additional guidance to the more than minor test is not specific enough, and that it cannot be said that the relief now sought was reasonably foreseeable as a direct or logical consequence of the relief sought in the submission. Fish and Game submits that there is scope for its submission for this change. In its submission for this change, at paragraph 8 of the submission, it identifies a non-exhaustive list of issues for Fish and Game, including uncertainty in the operative water plan around the environmental baseline to use when considering adverse effects, and regarding provisions 10A23 and 10A321, the submission states all other applications should be non-complying if they do not qualify for the controlled activity pathway. When considering this pathway, additional guidance should be given to the no more than minor test to describe this result in a surface water abstraction context. Fish and Game submits that the introduction of Table 10A24 is a method to achieve more certainty around the likely threshold for adverse effects on ecological health, and give guidance in terms of Section 95A8B and Section 104D assessments on whether ecological effects are likely to be more than minor due to the degree of hydrological alteration. There is also scope for this relief in a number of other submissions. The submission by MFE sought that the non-complying rule be deleted and a prohibited activity rule replace it, and MFE expressed concern that potential applicants would not be effectively deterred by the non-complying rule and raised the question of adequacy of the rule criteria, which are based on the operative water plan, which Professor Skelton's investigation found to be not fit for purpose. Mr. Sowell's submission expressly seeks that the no more than minor test is expanded on. At para 3, the submission states a pathway to issue consents up to 15 years in duration is not consistent with the findings of Professor Skelton or the recommendations of the Minister and should be removed as it derogates from the intended outcome of the plan change. If it is not removed, at the very least, a definition should be added as to what constitutes a no more than minor adverse effect, including in the cumulative sense in the context of surface water abstraction. I won't read out the rest of that. The WISE response submission seeks relief that before any consents are issued, an environmental flow regime is established for each river which is irrigated, it might be the wrong word, and that with that information, the council would be able to renew consents in the knowledge that the long-term health of the rivers was re-secured. The DOC submission, or Director General submission, seeks that policy 10A23 and rule 10A32 be improved by providing further criteria, including a range of suggested criteria that involve reviewing and maintaining various values and flows of catchments and water bodies. And the Forest and Bird submission raises the issue with the no more than minor test and seeks that it be replaced with outcomes that must be met. And at 21, I'll set out the quote, policy 10A23 provides an exemption to the 6 year consent duration on the basis of no more than minor effects is also problematic. It is uncertain on what basis no more than minor is determined, whether this is considered in terms of effects on specific values and includes localised impacts. This could be clarified by stating what is to be protected and maintained. And at 24H, the submission seeks that the policy be amended by removing the words no more than minor and replacing with outcomes that must be met, such as safeguarding life supporting capacity, ecosystem processes and Indigenous species, including their associated ecosystems of fresh water, to give effect to Objective B1 of the NPS. And finally, the Te O Marama submission also raises issue with the no more than minor test. Ngārunanga consider that the test in this policy of no more than minor adverse effects, including no more than minor cumulative effects on the ecology and hydrology of the surface water body, is not equivalent to upholding and protecting the Māori of water bodies whilst using the water in a way that provides for te hau ora or te taiao, te hau ora or te wai, and te hau ora or te tangata. So collectively, there's a lot of scope in those submissions, in a nutshell. On the merits, it is submitted that when put to them, the relevant experts generally agreed that the degree of hydrological alteration set out in the table recommended by Dr. Hayes could be determined on the basis that there is sufficient recorded data or the ability to model the degree of hydrological alteration. And secondly, that the degree of hydrological change is appropriate to trigger a presumption of more than minor adverse ecological effects unless comprehensive assessments are undertaken to displace that presumption. So Fish and Game also consider that the presumptive table is a useful benchmark given that many of the applications Fish and Game are seeing are significantly in excess of the scale of abstraction provided for in the table recommended by Dr. Hayes. And the court will hopefully recall Mr. Peregrine's big Appendix D, that big landscape table, along with his summary table, it is paragraph 83, showing examples of abstraction in excess of 1,000% of MELF compared to the presumptive standard of 20 or 30%, depending on the size of the river, and residual flows as low as 12% or less of MELF compared to presumptive minimum flow standard of 90 or 80%. And the significant contrast is just one way to illustrate just how extensive abstraction is in Otago and the scale of the challenge that the Land and Water Plan will have in assessing what changes in allocation are required in order to give effect to the NPSFM. And finally, I note that Mr. Tapelsmaker supports in principle providing further guidance to applicants and decision makers when making decisions that turn on whether effects are more than minor. And other witnesses also agreed guidance would be useful. Due to his concerns with the clarity and practicality of the use of Fish and Game's table 10A24 in the context of a policy, Mr. Tapelsmaker suggests the table not be in the plan. So having reflected on that and given the level of agreement that the presumptive table provides good guidance as to when the likely scale of effects at least require a comprehensive assessment to disprove a presumption of more than minor adverse effects, it is submitted that it would still be useful to have the guidance contained in PC7 to provide more certainty and consistency. And if the court finds it is not appropriate at the policy level, it is submitted that such guidance could be contained in very similar framework, meaning using the same words, in the methods schedule to PC7, so that assessments at that section 95A and section 104D stages of the process at least start from a consistent presumptive basis in terms of ecological effects.
So the methods, if you're going to introduce them as methods, sorry?
Sorry, I was just getting out the PC7
yes.
to see whether you
could
take us to
where
the judges
speak. Where
are you going to put us?
Where it would fit.
And I was just looking at the JWS version, the ninth JWS because it incorporates most of those changes, which are at least agreed.
Yep.
A few things in dispute, but that's okay. Where would you put it?
So you'd put it after 10A44, methodology for calculating annual volume limit. You'd put it, it's put it right at the end of the schedule.
Yeah.
And it would read basically the same as the draft policy from Mr. Farrell.
Hmm.
And the, so the heading would be, where's it gone? Actually, I haven't thought of a heading. The heading could be what the heading is for the table in Mr. Farrell's evidence, which is presumptive minimum flow and allocation thresholds. And then it would just be the wording of the proposed policy.
Hmm.
And the table.
All right. My question... Oh, how would you then... you would need to have some other narration, presumably, in the plan so that you could actually be queuing in applicants to be looking at that methodology. How would you go about that?
Well, I mean, given that the rest of the plan at the moment does not use... I think we've managed to get the reference to minor effects out of the rest of the body of the plan.
I think so.
Yeah. So I don't think it would need a signpost.
You don't think it needs a signpost?
Because the words aren't in there currently.
Well, how would a decision maker know that he or she had to apply the schedule or have regard to the
schedule? Look at
that method. Sorry?
How would a decision maker know to look at that method? Well, the most logical place would be under the non-complying rule 10A32 and have an advice note.
Okay, question for you. So, assuming that something, presume or assume that something like the ninth JWS is approved by the court, so, which is more or less, you know, your direction of travel. I mean, obviously, there's some debate around the objectives, which would need to be resolved, but there would be a controlled activity, RDA activity, including RDA for stranded assets, and something which will be announced tomorrow by Regional Council in relation to TAs, but not hydro. So that's where you're sitting.
That's where we're sitting, yes.
That's where you're sitting at the moment. And the objectives make clear that it's a process plan only. To the extent that there are some exceptions, there might be a hook in that objective, the Pete Anderson suggestion, saying these are the exceptions, whatever they are. And beyond that, there are very clear policies that say avoid or only allow. So if you were an applicant and you couldn't bring yourself under those exceptions or the controlled activity rule or RDA rules, which of themselves might seem to be exceptions anyway, you know, to the normal requirement to have a look at the effects in the environment. So if you can't bring yourself within that, you're left with a non-compliant activity. And the question that I put to Mr. De Palsmaker was, well, if you're left with a non-complying activity and you had very strong avoid policy, so avoid in relation to duration, obviously that's here we're only talking about deemed permits, and I know you want to bring in the new activity permits, but avoid in relation to duration, avoid in relation to irrigation area, so no more increases, and void in relation to, what's the other thing? It's a third avoid duration that is another avoid.
More water.
We've got, historic use.
Yeah, so no more water.
So avoid in relation to any increases over historic use. Three clear avoids. Sitting with a non-complying activity, if I was going to be doing any one of those three, that would strongly suggest probably that the application should be declined. Beyond that, if I was proposing something else, how does the non-complying activity, perhaps it doesn't, how does the non-complying activity rule work? I'm seeking an application which otherwise isn't covered by those policies or covered by those rules. It's a non-complying activity, which means that you just go through the usual test under Section 104D, or is there a fundamental problem with the structure of those void policies and the rules such that the gateway is effectively closed, both gates are effectively closed before you started? Because it seemed to me it was arguable that that the effects gateway, provided you weren't duration, historical use or irrigation area, the effects gateway was not yet firmly closed, as it might have been at the start of this process. And I wanted you to comment about that.
Well, if the three avoid directives were pure, you would have a prohibited rule. There wouldn't be an option for non-complying, and that's where the Minister started with their submission.
So why is that? Remind me, why do you think that is so under the current structure?
Well, the issue was a very practical issue because of the timing, because many, most, because of the effect, I can't remember the name of the section, if a prohibited rule is just a proposed prohibited rule, any applications lodged while it's just proposed are processed as discretionary. So we all quickly realised, despite initially supporting the prohibited rule, it wasn't going to act like a prohibited rule. It was actually worse. It was going to be back to discretionary. So, that's why we're all now focusing on how this non-complying rule works.
Okay, so I'm asking you about how the non-complying rule works.
Yep.
So, so how would a non-complying, absent your machinery, how would the non-complying rule work? Could it still work with all of the amendments which have been agreed to by the parties?
Would it still work?
Yeah, could it work?
Is there still a consenting pathway?
Yeah.
Yes, I think so. Despite the strong policy direction, if you're looking, if you're going through that first gateway, the 104D gateway, you're obviously not going to get through the policy gateway. You're clearly going to be contrary to the avoid policies, directions, but you might get through the
effects.
Less effects are no more than minor gateway, and then you get assessed on the merits again, subject to the same policy directions.
Yeah.
So it would have to be a very clearly, completely benign, effects-based proposal that didn't frustrate the long-term implementation of the NPSCFM to be approved.
So where we are today compared to where we were in the beginning, there is now a gateway strictly on effects.
Yes.
If you were looking for a longer consent, you'd probably still be knocked out by, you know, the durational policies, which are avoid. But if you weren't going with, if you weren't triggering one of those three avoid policies, if you weren't in that camp, then there's still a gateway via non-complying.
Yes, a very small one.
A very small one.
Yeah.
And so why introduce the fish and game, if that's correct, why introduce the fish and game assistance or guidance?
Guidance. For certainty, because if there is a proposal on the table that in a cumulative sense doesn't breach those flow allocation thresholds, then that's a fairly clear signal that the effects are minor or less, cumulatively even. And it's a... If there's agreement between the witnesses, and I've footnoted as many as I found, but there's probably some more references in the transcript, if there's agreement that that degree of hydrological alteration is a safe presumptive standard between going to be minor or less, or do more work to figure out if effects are minor or less. It's not you definitely effects are more than minor, it's do more work to figure out if effects are minor or less.
Now... with that in mind, if Ngāti Rangi applies and you're looking at the environment as it would have existed, you know, without those takes being in place, again, why go with the fish and game? So, except that with Ngāti Rangi applying, is it without the all of the takes or just the take that's under consideration for the decision maker in mind?
It's the environment absent any...
Any
consents that are going to expire.
Any consents that are going to expire, So just because, you know, consent A is before the decision maker would have to take into account all other permits expiring in relation to that that water body.
It wouldn't make any sense.
Otherwise it wouldn't make any sense.
Yep.
Okay, again, if that is true, why introduce the fish and game approach?
I guess it's still the same answer, just for... to have a certain point below which an application is most likely to be appropriate and above which it definitely needs a lot more work to determine whether or not it meets the minor or less threshold.
But as I understand the table, it's not a test, but it's indication.
A trigger to do more work.
A trigger to do more work. Do you lose some sense of that trigger to do more work by including it as a methodology?
Maybe. Yep.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
That's food for thought. Thank you very much.
Very good.
Okay, so who are we with? Who's next? Ms. Williams. I say that not looking at the schedule. I should look at the schedule, sorry. Ms. Dixon's next, but not here, so that's fine.
Yes. I am ready to go, Your Honour.
You're ready to go.
So great. If you are willing to hear from me, then... Mm-hmm.
We're in your hands.
Your Honour, I do have to apologise. Our printers automatically do double-sided, and I didn't even think about it.
Oh, no. It's just such a strong preference, because I tend to write all over these, and, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So apologies for the fact that they mm-hmm. are not double-sided. I'm sorry that they are double-sided and not single-sided.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I have to apologise for up front is that I had a mental note to deal with Section 124 and I didn't. So I will deal with that at an appropriate point, but just to let
Very
you know
good.
That it's not actually in the written subs. Mm-hmm. So I apologise for that also. So, Your Honour, I thought I'd actually start by going mm-hmm. back to the Director-General's submission and where the Director-General started on Plan Change 7. And so the original submission supported the transitional nature of the plan, but it really did seek a process plus version be implemented. Mm. And so I just want to confirm that the Director-General does support purpose to provide a simple, efficient, cost-effective transition from the operative plan to sustainable management of freshwater resources in Otago under an integrated planning framework, including the recently notified proposed regional policy statement and the anticipated new land and water regional plan. And in my opening legal submissions for the Director General, I clarified the concerns are principally about threatened non-diagramous galaxias, and I've included in a footnote there, Your Honour, just a reference to the definition of diadromous and non-diadromous, which was in Dr. Dunn's evidence way back when. So that's just there for clarity. The Director-General wants to ensure that Plan Change 7 does not result in changes to existing water flow and hydrology patterns, which could worsen the existing environment for these fish and their habitats over the transitional period that Plan Change 7 is in place. So on that basis, there are some specific relief which was sought in the original submission, which is abandoned, mm-hmm. and that includes seeking implementation of relevant Schedule 2A minimum flows. Originally, the Director General sought flow triggers or banding to provide for priorities, sought in-stream values providing for life-supporting capacity of non-migratory galaxids and other freshwater species, and protection of significant habitats, and additional matters of control to protect non-diadromous galaxias and maintain habitat diversity. So those were additional matters which were sought to be put into, I think, the rules, Your Honour, and those specific matters of relief are formally abandoned, and mm-hmm. I just wanted to clarify that. However, he does seek that Plan Change 7 enables the activities to continue operating during the transition period at their existing scale and consistent with the historical use. And that picks up, Your Honour, on the version B of the 10A12 objective. And that is my emphasis there on existing scale and consistent with historical use. Mm. So continuing activities on that basis will maintain the existing environment for non-diadromous galaxias and other freshwater species and their habitats. Plan Change 7 does not claim or intend to enhance habitats or provide additional environmental protection. However, I submit Plan Change 7 must not result in changes to the patterns of existing scale and historical use activities, which may significantly worsen the existing environment for galaxids and other freshwater species. And on that basis, the Director General supports a simple process version of the plan change. Mm-hmm. Your Honour, I submit that replicating priorities is necessary to continue activities at the existing scale and consistent with the historical use of water in Otago. Plan Change 7 needs to bridge the gap to a new integrated planning framework. That's why it is important to replicate priorities where these are present. Where takes with higher priorities exist downstream of other takes in a catchment, the presence of priorities has shaped historic use patterns by imposing a default allocation of water between users and thereby providing an incidental environmental benefit by retaining water in-stream longer. Even where priorities have not been formally exercised, their presence has shaped existing patterns of use through the knowledge that they can be called upon in situations of insufficient flows. And I have referenced there, Your Honour, some of the parts of the transcript from the Cromwell hearing. Mm-hmm. In response to this, water users have come up with various informal, and in some cases, and I think here perhaps of the Falls Dam Agreement, formal water sharing arrangements to address low flow circumstances, all of which are underpinned by priorities. I submit when replacing deemed permits, Plan Change 7 must include a mechanism to replicate priorities to continue activities operating at their existing scale consistent with historical use. This will ensure the incidental environmental benefit priorities provide to Otago's freshwater ecosystems, not just to non-diagenous glaxias and their habitats, is maintained during the transition period. Turning to how the plan change can replicate or mimic priorities, in response to the court's directions, the planners have conference resulting in the 8th joint witness statement. In that joint witness statement, the four policy planners assessed various management approaches under Section 32 and concluded that replicating priorities was best. Ms. King and the technical staff preferred not trying to replicate priorities as they had concerns about consenting and compliance issues and addressed those concerns further on. I've set out at paragraph 14, Your Honour, the approach from the 8th Joint Witness Statement, and I'm not sure that I really need to take you through that. At 15, the court does not favour the 8th Joint Witness Statement approach. The court provided alternative wording, a new policy, entry condition, reserved matters of control and discretion, which were further refined by counsel for ORUG. The planners are considering this refined wording, and I understand there is new wording to come, and potentially a further witness panel presentation tomorrow. I don't have the advantage of having seen that before I wrote these submissions. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to set out really what I thought were the essential elements that we need to consider for priorities. So this is what I've set out at paragraph 17. And at A, the current deemed permit as at 30 September is subject to permits with high priorities, which are downstream, because it is the downstream which is very important here. The second point is that there is not enough available water to supply the downstream higher priority permit at the point of take. And then the third factor is that if the lower priority permit ceases taking water, that will result in the downstream higher priority permit having an available water supply.
Are you? Now, I obviously agree with taking an elemental approach because I suggested that. What in plain English is actually going on here, and I think you're capturing that. But so your paragraph 18 is to the effect of whatever comes next, it should it should have this content. Okay.
Yes. And so again, I perhaps won't go through paragraph 18. It's trying to try and fit that. And I'm not a planner, Your Honour. I will really accept that. So this is just again trying to put this forward. And to me, and as I say at para 19, I wanted to get away from residual flow, because residual flow is used in a particular way in the plan. It references back to policy 646, 7. Mm.
I'm not bothered by that. I mean, I put residual flow in and highlighted it at the time, saying that might not actually be the correct term, and then I think it was suggested that it just be knocked back to flow.
Yes.
And that's fine.
And equally, Your Honour, it did seem that there was some concern about what sufficiency or insufficient might mean.
I know, and that's simply because it's language plucked from
the Water and Soil Conservation Act.
And I suspect any farmer would know what a sufficient flow means without much definition. Yeah.
But yes, but there just seemed to be some concerns about those terms. So that was why I was thinking about what's another way to look at this. And it seemed that really the fundamental question is, do I have water available to me for my supply or not? Mm. And that's a very simple factual question. Do I have water, available water, to meet my supply? And if I don't, will the person here upstream from me turning off, stopping their take, mean that I do get water? Because those are the things that matter.
But that still goes to sufficiency, though. You shouldn't just be asking your neighbour to turn off if you've got sufficient water.
Yes.
Well, it'd be a bit perverse, wouldn't it? And the thing that Ms King was worried about, I think. But anyway, I think it's the general agreement on what that looks like.
Yes, Your Honour. So carrying on at para 20, as I've said, I've considered this as a water allocation and supply issue. So on an allocation basis, the lower priority take should only be required to cease taking water when the downstream take does not have available water for its supply. And I've also tried to link the requirement to cease taking to actual availability and supply of water to the higher take, because in my submission, if the cessation of take by the lower priority makes no difference to the available water downstream, then there shouldn't be a requirement to cease the take. It shouldn't
I think
be
that's the point I was getting at. You'd be really perverse to be asking, you know, to be doing that.
Yep. Absolutely. Yes.
All right. So you're saying this, is this another option, or is this a checklist against whatever comes in from the planners? Because broadly speaking, I don't think that the policy that I drafted, the policy that I drafted captures this.
Yes.
But as I indicated at the time, it needed refinement.
Yes. Mm. Yes. So I understand that the council also may have some additional wording. And
is that new policies or new provisions?
Mr. Moore will have to answer that. I think he's taken the ORUG wording potentially and worked from that.
From that, okay. But so it's not a third option. Now looking at you, Mr. Moore, apparently something you wrote.
Yes, I'd describe it as a refinement of the option that had been put forward and commented on by Mr. Page and refined to address some of the issues which have occurred over the intervening days.
That's right. I think it is a joint legal and planning issue, this one, very much, which is why we're still here debating the words.
Yes.
Perhaps, yeah.
Anyway, so really, in essence, Your Honour, I'm not trying to put forward another option, but I'm just trying to put forward, I guess, my thinking on how this works. Moving, Your Honour, to the question of can the council impose enforceable conditions to replicate priorities? And this is addressing the concerns, firstly, from Ms King and the technical witnesses.
I don't think I need to hear from you about that. I think I've already indicated that.
You're not concerned?
I'm not concerned. I think if ORC's house is not in order, and if that also applies to farmers in terms of how they have been operating or beyond or outside of the, you know, their permit conditions or consent conditions, that is something that needs to be addressed. But I can't see that we can do nothing. I think something has to be done.
Yes.
ORC's brings its house back into a state of order in terms of its management and control of information, and likewise farmers, and they might need to apply for additional permissions if they have, shifted their point of take or transferred informally the permit to another person. I don't know how they do that. But But something may need to be done, and the onus is on them.
Yes.
And you see, this is difficult. So if, I mean, I don't know what's gone on out there, but I do know that RRC says it hasn't had any oversight. I think any oversight was what was used. So if permits have been transferred to new permit holders from different locations or different points of take, how that ends up in the wash, I can't foresee. But it may well be that to get through, you know, if it's PC7's confirmed, to get through these sort of controls, the applicant is obligated to go down a pathway wherein they accept other conditions from or other restrictions by other persons, and it may not be an order priority. I can't see how it's going to be resolved.
No, and I suspect that, I mean, those issues, Your Honour, are not really confined to the issue of priorities, because they're just factors of if you are seeking to replace a permit and the ownership of the permit is complex, and many of them are, that doesn't matter whether there's priorities there or not. That's just on any replacement, you're going to be facing those same issues. I have to say that I do suspect that part of the complexity has arisen because of the fact that initially these mining privileges were granted many, many moons ago, and the privileges attached to the specific points of take. So, and then the infrastructure following on from that point of take. And so because of that, that's meant that, you know, there's been shares and then sort of, you know, parts of shares and those complications in terms of ownership have arisen because of the that historical nature, and people holding on to that original grant at that point. And that's part of the reason for the complexity. And, you know, I suspect that many of the replacements which have already gone through have actually already dealt with, amalgamated, et cetera. But that's not what we're dealing with here and now. What we are dealing with here and now is those which have not yet been replaced, which are due to expire in October, and where applications to replace have now been made. So that's what we're dealing with.
Anyway, those, apart from foreshadowing that there are complexities, perhaps within the existing arrangements which users have come to, absent any regulatory oversight, and that's Ms King's evidence and also Mr Cummings' evidence, I'm not sure what the court can do about that. We're not being placed in a position through primary evidence or factual evidence to have a good understanding of those issues. Most it can do is suggest a simple mechanism, and I would have expected parties with an interest in this, in particular the primary sector, to have said if there were fundamental concerns about those mechanisms. And I didn't. We did ask Ms Dicey whether there would be, for example, in relation to the main stem of Matahere Kea, as an example of a longish water body, and she didn't indicate to us that there would be any issues arising.
No, and I think that's right, Your Honour. I think, again, it comes back to that the complex background landscape is a landscape within which water users have been operating in any event, and they will continue to navigate that between themselves and also with council, and I don't think the court actually needs to get involved in that.
All right, thank you.
Your Honour, I do spend quite a long time on the enforcement question, so I don't know whether you want me to run through any of that or whether...
I don't. I will read it. We will read it, but no, at this stage, I think our viewers need the mechanism. Yep.
All right, Your Honour. Perhaps if I just... The thing that I probably do want to reiterate is that we have had quite a lot of evidence about the influence, the community influence around the way priorities are exercised or not exercised, and the way in which it has facilitated and encouraged existing water sharing arrangements. And really, Your Honour, my submission ultimately is that those can be expected to continue, that the enforcement of priorities on an individual basis is very rare, and I really don't foresee that the council is going to have to do any much. And with respect, I agree with my friend Mr. Page that it will probably continue to firstly be between the holders as opposed to anybody else. And if at some point there is a wish or a want to look at some kind of enforcement action, council also has the opportunity to educate the higher priority holders about what actually is required of them, and to facilitate discussions between the two permit holders. So there's lots of options before we actually get to that. I do want to address, Your Honour, the suggestion of alternative enforcement mechanisms, and here I'm at para 37, and that those could be an appropriate or better tool to replace a priorities consent condition.
Oh, right. This is section 17 and 329.
Yes, Your Honour. And really, where I've got to on that, Your Honour, is that actually the adverse environmental effect has occurred at the point that you are looking to invoke either of those mechanisms. So for galaxids, that could mean that populations and other species present and maintained by the exercise of priorities may already have been lost as part of the adverse environmental effects before the council's threshold to pursue that mechanism is reached. And so I don't favour those as an alternative.
All right. Well, unless you want to take us through paras 37 through 39, we'll hold the adjournment now forward for lunch. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honour.
Right, thank you. We'll adjourn through to 1:30.
All rise.